Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, I have as my guest the extraordinary William T. Vollman, Bill Vollman, whose newest book in the Seven Dreams series has just been published. It's called The Dying Grass. It's a credit to its publisher, Viking, and its editor, Paul Slovak, and its writer, William T. Vollman. Now, this is a book about the Nez Perce Wars. When we say the Nez Perce Wars, it's the Nez Perce War, isn't it? It's something essentially that lasted approximately 4 months. Am I right?
That's right, Michael.
And why do we think of it as wars? Do we group it with all of the Indian wars?
Maybe that's part of it. Maybe it's the fact that the battles were so widely different. It's hard to say.
When you read this book, you discover, or to put it personally, I discover that everything I thought I knew is wrong. I knew of a central man named Chief Joseph. Well, Chief Joseph wasn't his name. What was his name?
Haymat Tuyalakekt.
How do we get Chief Joseph?
He was at one time baptized Ephraim, and then he was offered the name of Joseph, and it was certainly a lot easier for the whites to say.
And the general who's facing him is leading an army in part of volunteers, but an army that has not really gone home after the Civil War. They have been sent off to fight the war that will take the Nez Perce off their land in, is it Washington?
In Oregon, Northeast Oregon. But some of them were later put on a reservation in Washington.
And so these men have not had a rest. They've not yet aired out their feelings about black people, and they are no better with their feelings about Indians.
That's right, Michael. President Grant once said that had it not been for the Civil War, the Indians of the Plains and West might have been left in their homeland for another 100 years. But as soon as the Civil War was over, this immense apparatus that the North had built up of railroads and industrial capability fell into the hands of the businessmen. That's where you start seeing the rise of corporate America. And corporate America thought how great it would be to take over the West.
And it determines the future of America, or even what you're calling the future of the North American continent. Yes?
That's right, Michael. Yeah, it's so strange to think, you know, that in 1877, the buffalo were still running free. Meanwhile, in the East Coast, there was industrialized coal mining. There was a steam-powered dynamo. You know, there were pseudo-electric lights in the streets.
Kind of amazing to live in these books, because the Seven Dreams volumes will take you to a world that existed, but it's so alive and vital and strange that I didn't know so much about, well, medicine at that time, what the nature of prejudice and the language of prejudice was like, that it was common. There are so many things that William Vollmann, in doing his research, brings to bear on a book. How do you go about researching a book like this?
Well, I try to read as widely as I can. And the more I read, the more I realize what I need to read. I remember I once went to a place in Walla Walla, Washington, that had a reconstructed fort and a hospital, some other things. Some of the soldiers in the Nez Perce War are buried there. And so I started looking at the labels on the medicines and saying, okay, I need to know what these are and what they use, you know, what the ingredients are. And that's going to tell me something about what these people think and the effects on them. You know, speaking of medicine, my 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica still recommends calomel, which is a mixture of opium and mercury, as a specific for all kinds of things, for diarrhea, for sores. And imagine these people just drinking mercury and getting addicted to narcotics and not realizing what they were doing to themselves.
And their horses, rubbing down the horses
with white
sometimes,
lead.
Yes, and sometimes with the same medicines that they're using for themselves.
That's right.
Because after all, the army, and this is what, I mean, of a book that made me cry, dare I say, innumerable times, my first shocked tears came as I realized, well, the army has been ever thus. These men are wearing boots that are falling apart and the nails are digging into their heels. Their equipment is substandard. Their horses are worn out. They're the same horses that have been riding in the Civil War. The number of horses being stolen and shot, and the tendency of the Indians to lame their horses because they didn't want the Americans to be taking horses from them that were healthy.
That's right.
And strong. So all of our treatment has to be understood as being part of a world in which no one is good, no one is right. There are aspects of ethics that people are exploring. The Americans are not all bad. The hero, one of the two heroes of the book, General
O.O. Howard. Yeah.
Yeah. He considers himself a Christian, but he's not a demented Christian. He is as horrified to learn of a Christian Indian school that says, we kill the Indian and save the man. This is not his idea of Christian virtue. His idea of Christian virtue is that many things other than Christian can exists simultaneously. Yes, he doesn't want his men to drink and swear, but those are army regulations. He's not prissy, it seems. Am I right?
He's a very complicated man, and I think in many ways, you know, does give Christians a good name, but he's very limited. You know, General Sherman said that he was very easily used and therefore did not have the confidence of the businessmen, which says a lot about him and a lot about General Sherman.
Yes, indeed. I'm talking to William T. Vollman about his newest book, The Dying Grass, which is a novel of the Nez Perce War. He was one of the founders and funders of the Black College. What is it?
Howard University.
Named after him. And he has a sense of the dignity of the Indians. It's a almost, well, very rare among the people we meet in this book. Where does it come from? Did you find a source?
Howard really believed that all people were equally deserving. He was not a racist and suffered greatly for not being so. He was humiliated and sued and accused for many, many years for being the head of the Freedmen's Bureau at the end of the Civil War, trying to help the freed slaves. And all the promises that the government made to the African Americans were undone, and Howard was blamed. And, you know, one of his faults, I think, was a tendency, you know, a la Candide, to think that in the long run, everything happens for the best, you know, and that it has to happen for the best because of God. So he convinced himself, you know, that in the long run, maybe it was better off for the blacks that their lands were restored to the planters. And he was quite sure that the Indians would be better off if they became settled on the reservations and Christianized. In a way, you can see where he was coming from. He believed with a lot of justice that nobody could stop the settlers from pouring in. The army was helpless. There weren't enough people in the army to stop people from stealing the Indian lands.
You see, this book gave me a dynamic sense of history. There were lands wide enough for the Indians to be satisfied with a treaty. What does this mean? The Indians had to be able to wander. There are seasonal hunting grounds, and they have to move with the seasons. The earth cannot be considered theirs. No one owns the earth.
That's
the
right.
The earth is the mother. We don't own our mother. And so along come these settlers. They found gold, or what they think is gold, or what they think is a bonanza on the Indian lands, and then you can't keep them off. The Indian lands cannot be maintained as Indian lands. Who is going to protect them? The army? The understaffed army? How? And so they offer a significantly smaller treaty. Same land, but what? An eighth the size?
Or much less.
Much less, yeah. Really. You have a drawing of it. And it's just because you can't enforce that the land will belong to the Native Americans. In a strange way that I'd never considered, the treatment of the freed black men is a prototype for what becomes the treatment of the Indians. We know one thing, that we're not good at this, and we have a belief in inferior races, because after all, most Americans who came to America were once considered the inferiors of whatever culture they lived in. It's why they left.
That's right, Michael. And they were so used to not getting along with the other and so hungry and desperate and aggressive. You know, there was natural selection for aggressiveness, the people who came over there. And one difference, you know, in the treatment of the blacks and the Indians was that, you know, the black slaves had been imported as laborers. And so there was a sense in the South that, okay, we need to immediately re-enslave or re-indenture these people somehow because they are useful to us. We can make them work really hard for very little and we can exploit their labor. But the Indians had no particular motivation to labor in that way. And they were sitting on natural resources, whether it was gold mines or grasslands for stockmen. So it was better just to get rid of them.
Now, into the thick of things. This, The Dying Grass, is a novel, and yet there are nearly 200 pages of notes and sources and glossaries and chronologies. At what point did you decide these would be novels? There are 7 dreams, 2 are yet to come, and not works of history? Because you've done so much research, and you tell your reader, whoever wants to know, exactly when you're straying from strict accuracy.
That's right. I think in the very first of the 7 dreams, I realized that I wanted to have the license to inhabit myth or to move characters here and there in ways that they didn't actually do. You know, in The Dying Grass, for instance, there's a character named Perry who was responsible really for the second greatest defeat the U.S. Army had ever suffered, the greatest being Little Bighorn. He lost to the Nez Perce at Whitebird Canyon in Idaho. And I read enough of what Howard wrote about him and his court of inquiry as well, the testimony there, to see that Howard was like a father to him and wanted to help him. What Perry really thought of Howard, I'm not sure. But I thought, well, this dynamic has already been created between them. Let's have Perry stay with Howard for almost all of the chase of Joseph instead of sending him off somewhere else, which is what actually happened. One of the biggest problems in narrating this book from at least the cavalry point of view is that different detachments would come in and out of the action as Howard was moving northeast after Joseph. And so it's a lot to ask of the reader to say, okay, all right, and now this character is done for no good reason and you have to learn somebody else. I couldn't see any reason to do that.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with William Volman about his book, The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with William Volman about his recent book, The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War, the latest in the series 7 Dreams, Book of North American Landscape. Now, this book swept me up in its rhythms. And by rhythms, the first I would like to say is the alternation between the native peoples and the general and his troops. And there's an implicit comparison between a tribe and a battalion, that we're being asked silently to build. I began to be very moved between what is something like the poetic language of the tribe and the business is business language. It has its own rhythms, and General Howard is nearly astonishing as the chairman of the board, saying, yes, thank you for that. You can tell me that later. Now, and it has a rhythm of its own, but it's the rhythm of the boardroom, in a sense. It's the rhythm of people being put in their own place.
His daughter, Grace, always used to say that she remembered watching her father talking to someone while signing papers, having to do with something else, and keeping someone else waiting. He was a very, very energetic guy. And so interesting to think, too, that, you know, losing an arm at the Battle of Fair Oaks didn't slow him down a bit. It seemed like he could outwalk and outride most of his own soldiers. What a tough man he was.
Yes. What did the Nez Perce call him?
Cut Arm.
Yes. And they have nicknames for everyone. So do the soldiers. And what we're beginning to see as we read this book is that we're living in a world where everyone has their own names for things, for plants, for animals, affectionate names for your horse that may be different from the names that other people use for that same horse.
That's right.
That we're living in a world of multiplied nomenclature that makes for a sense of variety and wondrousness.
And I think, too, that, that was the case for the cavalry as well. And it's possible that our language is a little more impoverished, our world is more impoverished, or it might simply be that a lot of those things are gone and we have other things to replace them. It is, you know, sort of bittersweet.
Well, that's fascinating because many of the foods that we see the Nez Perce eat require that they be pounded, and I'd never tasted so many of the bitter roots that you write about. Are they there to be tasted? Have you tasted them?
I've tasted some of them, yeah. I've tasted camas, which the Nez Perce first gave to Lewis and Clark. And it's a beautiful, beautiful herb. Sometimes it looks like an ocean because it's all these blue flowers in a big meadow. But the settlers rooted it up. Their pigs would dig it up. It was another procedure in denying the food source to the Indians.
And you have to remember that the Nez Perce were thought to be the most generous to the early settlers, to Lewis and Clark. They would give them food. They'd give them instruction. We had gotten what? Ungrateful. Because after all, this is the origin, supposedly, of Thanksgiving as well. We took it as a matter of course that we would be treated well by the people we would subsequently vanquish.
Yeah, that's all too true, Michael.
Do you think, as you travel west, was there any idea that this destruction was a part of Manifest Destiny? Did it go without saying?
Absolutely. The destruction of the buffalo was in part just greed, and in part it was deliberate policy. They knew that the Indians could not survive, the ones who fed on buffalo, who built their teepees and made robes out of buffalo skins, once these herds were gone. Once the buffalo disappeared just north of the U.S.-Canadian border, Sitting Bull had to give up and surrender. And they considered it was absolutely the right thing, and we could feel a little sad about it, but, you know, that's just how it is.
As you read The Dying Grass, and I recommend it very highly. You become aware, too, that some of these roots are ground to become part of the war paints, and we're going to watch the Indians adorn their bodies, adorn their clothing, and become dazzling. Their connection with the natural world and the animal world, the feathers that they gather, the robes that they wear, all of it is being part of the earthly procedures. This book is inherently dramatic. It's an epic battle between ways of life, ways of speech, ways of seeing, and we will talk more about these ways of seeing and how to embody them in prose between the covers of a book next week. I've been talking with William Vollman, author of The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War, published by Viking. Thank you, Bill, for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Michael. I appreciate it.
I admire your ability, and I think that of the many books I've read of yours, this moved me, sometimes destroyed me, very intensely.
Yeah, sometimes it's painful when I read it aloud in the bookstores, and I know what's coming.
Yeah, well, and yet, is it safe to say that the accuracy is what makes it beautiful as well?
I hope, you know, it was as accurate as I could make it, and the landscapes are so beautiful, the languages are beautiful, so I did my best.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Dying Grass at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when William Vollman is our guest.